Peace on Earth.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam, and you're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. 10 years ago, almost to the day, then-President Barack Obama called income inequality the defining challenge of our time. And there's a lot of evidence to back up that claim, including research showing that rising inequality leads to poor economic growth and innovation, lower levels of happiness and trust in the population, and reduced social mobility, the ability of someone born in poverty to escape it. But perhaps the biggest danger from rising economic inequality is what it's doing to our bodies, to our health. Economic inequality is killing us, literally. In this episode of Policy for the People, we hear from Dr. Steven Besruchka, author of the book, Inequality Kills Us All. A former emergency room physician, Steven is currently an associate teaching professor emeritus at the University of Washington School of Public Health. But before we get to our discussion on how inequality is killing us, we get a quick update on the latest figures on income inequality in Oregon. Here's my colleague from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, Tyler McInnes, discussing the key takeaways from a new report. Tyler, you just wrote a paper explaining the most recent figures on income inequality in Oregon. What's the main takeaway from that report?
Well, the main takeaway is that by several measures, income inequality in Oregon has hit a new high. And I should start by explaining that the information we're discussing here is tax data that's provided to us by the Oregon Department of Revenue. And our data set goes back four decades, back to 1980. And looking at the most recently available data, we're talking about tax year 2021. And what we see in that latest data is that there are new records in terms of the income flowing to the ultra rich, as well as to the merely rich. We also saw a new record in terms of the distance separating the typical Oregonian, or the Oregonian in the middle, and those at the very top, the ultra rich. So the bottom line is that income inequality that's been building for decades continues in Oregon unabated.
You mentioned the ultra rich. Who are they? How much money are they making? And how does their income compare to that of the Oregonian in the middle that you also referenced?
Yeah, so when I say the ultra-rich, I'm talking about the richest one out of every 1,000 Oregonians. So we're talking about the top one-tenth of the 1%. And in 2021, the average member of this group collected nearly $8 million in income. And since 1980, the average income for someone in this group has gone up by nearly 700% in inflation-adjusted terms. By comparison, the median Oregonian, or the Oregonian in the middle, has seen a raise of just about 15% over that same four-decade span. So in 2021, the Oregonian in the middle was taking home a little less than $44,000. One way to think about this difference, or this gulf that we see between the typical Oregonian and those at the very top, is that the typical Oregonian would need to work for 182 years to earn the same income that the average member of the top one-tenth of the 1% took home in 2021. That's longer than Oregon has existed as a state. And just to put that into greater context, back in 1980, the average member of the ultra-rich made 26 times what the Oregonian in the middle made at that time. And 26 times is a big difference, but it's just a fraction of the 182 times difference that we see today. So, you know, the ultra-rich may work hard, but they're not working 182 times harder than the typical Oregonian. They aren't 182 times as smart or as talented. And so if they aren't that much more talented or aren't working that much harder, why do we see this gulf between those at the very top and everyone else? And really, what we see in terms of income inequality is the product of policy choices that have been made over the years to favor the rich over everyone else. Policy choices such as cutting their taxes, and also making it harder for workers to organize and fight for better pay and working conditions.
You also mentioned a record high with regard to the income of the merely rich. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so when I'm talking about the merely rich, I'm referring to the richest one out of every 100 Oregonians. That would be the top 1%. That group also saw their average income reach $1.7 million in 2021, which smashed the previous record set in 2007, just before the start of the Great Recession. The top 1% together collect more income than the bottom half of all Oregonians. And we know from the data that it's not just the ultra-rich, that top one-tenth of the 1%, that's pulling the incomes of the broader 1% higher. The rest of the top 1% is still doing very well when we exclude the ultra-rich. So we've seen incomes really explode at the top while remaining stagnant for folks in the middle.
In a moment, we're going to hear from Dr. Steven Besruchka about how economic inequality is killing us. So I was wondering if you can say how income inequality that we've been discussing relates to this other term, economic inequality.
Economic inequality is a catch-all term for the different ways of measuring the unequal distribution of economic resources. So we can measure inequality by differences in how much people make in a year, and that would be income inequality, which is what we've been discussing here. We could also talk about inequality in terms of pay levels, which would be wage inequality. Or we could focus on inequality in terms of the value of what people own, all of their assets minus their debts. And that would be wealth inequality. And inequality has been growing across the board, whether you're looking at wages, income, and wealth. And it's important to note that wealth inequality is probably the most impactful of these, both in terms of what it means to be economically secure in our country, and also in terms of the degree of inequality that we see in the data. As unequal as income is, inequality by wealth is even more extreme, and it's by a lot. So for example, last year we published a paper providing the first ever estimate of wealth inequality in Oregon, and it showed that one billionaire alone, the wealthiest person in Oregon, Phil Knight, had more wealth than the bottom half of all Oregonians combined. So when we're talking about wealth inequality, we're really talking about inequality at mind-boggling levels.
That was Tyler McInnes, policy analyst at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, discussing the latest figures on income inequality in Oregon. The continued rise of inequality does not bode well for our health. According to our next guest, Dr. Steven Besruchka, here's our discussion on how inequality is killing us all. Hi, Steven. Welcome to Policy for the People.
Thank you very much for having me, Juan Carlos.
So life expectancy, how long people live is a fundamental measure of a nation's well-being. Can you talk to us about what's been happening in terms of life expectancy in the U.S., both before and after COVID, and how does it compare to the experiences of other industrialized, wealthy countries?
To me, life expectancy is the most vital measure of a society because it refers to people's health. I worked as an emergency doctor for 30 years, and the easiest diagnosis I could make in the emergency department was that somebody was dead. It's very hard to fake. Once that happened, all I had to do was fill out a death certificate, and that got sent to the state, and it was matched with the birth certificate. And so we have measures of how long people lived. Now, when I went to medical school, I learned that in the 1950s, we were one of the longest lived countries in the world. One of the miracles of the last century has been the vast improvements in our health. But now, using this measure, life expectancy, some over 40 countries have longer lives than we do. And these include all the other rich countries and some not so rich, such as Chile or Costa Rica or Slovenia or even China. We are about 8 years behind the longest lived country, which is Japan. And so we are falling behind in our health outcomes. And the more serious issue is, you know, remember, life expectancy had been improving, but it stopped improving in the United States around 2015 and has in fact declined absolutely. And that is just a very rare phenomenon. This is outside of COVID. Yes, COVID produced a decline much greater in the United States than in other rich countries. But the fact that our life expectancy now is about what it was in 1996 is very troubling, because in 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, Russia's life expectancy plummeted. I fear we could be following Russia's trajectory.
To what extent does our nation's vast economic inequality, which is much higher than most other, if not all, wealthy industrialized countries, explain the fact that we tend to live shorter lives than people in those other countries?
So, you know, I like simple phrases, and inequality kills us all is the title of my book, suggesting that economic inequality is, in fact, the poison that is dispatching us early. Think about economic inequality as a highly toxic, very poisonous, colorless, odorless gas that surrounds us and kills us from the usual disease conditions, heart disease, cancer, mass shootings, and other things, and we're totally unaware of it. So how does it do that? Well, there are several mechanisms that one can use to describe that, but it forces us to make comparisons between ourselves and others. And this is sort of fed throughout society by lifestyles of the rich and famous, by the wealth they display, by the ads, the advertising that targets us, the social media that points out how others have it so much better. So being aware of this inequality creates an enormous amount of stress in us. And when we look at stress physiology, it's what's killing us. And so, you know, to explain our poor health status, most people would typically say it's medical care. And the other is it's our personal behaviors. Well, it's neither of those things. It's the highly toxic stress that is killing us in ways that we can describe biologically.
So So there was a remarkable story in the Washington Post recently on the impact of chronic disease, things like heart disease and cancer, on the life expectancy in our country. Is the rise of chronic disease affecting people at an earlier life, is that tied to that stress that you were talking about before?
Oh, absolutely. The other important thing to understand is the importance of early life. During the first 1,000 days after conception, roughly half of our health as adults is programmed. In other words, healthier societies privilege early life. And they can do it in a variety of ways, such as if a pregnant woman is working, does she get paid parental leave once she has her baby as a national policy? There are only two countries in the world with populations of 1 million or more who do not give a working woman who's pregnant paid leave after she has her baby. One is, of course, the United States. The other is Papua New Guinea. So if we can't provide resources and time for a parent to parent, the outcomes are going to be not so favorable. So in those first 1,000 days, the first 9 months in the womb, the fetus is scanning the outside world, and through mother's hormones that cross the placenta, it views the outside world and says, is it going to be a nice, friendly, warm, nurturing world, and I can take time to fully develop my organs and be born at term and enjoy a healthy early life? Or is it a hostile world out there? Is it going to be really nasty and I'm going to have to compromise my development in utero to pop out early to survive, to reproduce? Because we humans are here for only one evolutionary purpose. We have to survive to reproduce, or this species dies out like the dodo. And if we once we reproduce, that is, have babies, we can pay the price with chronic diseases as we age, heart disease, cancers, and so on. So the situation is really biologically programmed so that the chronic diseases that we suffer from as we age result from the not so salutary or healthy conditions in early life. And economic inequality is what produces those unhealthy conditions in early life.
Is this impact being felt mainly among people in the lower rungs of the economic ladder? Are they the ones bearing the brunt, or is it affecting middle-class folks, upper-income class folks?
So it affects everybody. That's why I said inequality kills us all. As I pointed out, the United States is less healthy than 40-plus other countries. The longest-lived person is never in this country. And the wealthiest among us tend to be healthier than those less healthy, but the richest are certainly not among the longest-lived in the world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to our conversation with Dr. Stephen Bestruchka, author of the book Inequality Kills Us All. And we're discussing how economic inequality is harming our health and reducing life expectancy in our nation. You mentioned in your book that the shortest life expectancy that we see in this country are in counties where you find reservations, as well as places where slavery predominated in the South.
Yes.
Can you talk about the role of racism, past and present, in the health outcomes that we see today?
So, Indian reservations. I mean, remember, we had a historical policy of enforced genocide, and we eventually pushed the Indians elsewhere. They're called indigenous, but we forced them onto reservations in horrific conditions. The worst outcomes in the country are in Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and in the southern end of South Dakota. And we've been looking at trends. And so they have the lowest life expectancy in the country there. And furthermore, the declines, remember I mentioned our life expectancy is declining. The life expectancy declines in Pine Ridge are horrific. Men live about 40 to 50 years there, and women only do a little better. And you see, when you see a map of U.S. counties by life expectancy, you see the color scheme with red being the lowest life expectancy. The upper Midwest is where a lot of the good health is, except that within there are these areas of red that represent Indian reservation. Then the other part of the colored map of U.S. counties show poor health, lower life expectancy in the Mississippi Valley and Appalachia and in the Southeast. And it's basically where we had a lot of slavery. And what we know from slavery was that slaves were not kept healthy because, you know, you let them die and then you raise their children and they, of course, become slaves. So there's a phenomenon called that explains both the indigenous and the poor health in the Southeast of intergenerational transmission of health. What that means is that health is passed, health status, from one generation to the next. One way of making this clear is that you and I both, in some sense, started life in our maternal grandmother's womb, because the ovum that your father's sperm fertilized, your mother made when she was inside her mother, your maternal grandmother. So your maternal grandmother's conditions have to affect your health. And we can demonstrate this in research studies. The grandfather on both sides matters too. It's just that you don't see the anatomic or physical link between the ovum that your mother produced, that your father's sperm fertilized, that begat you. But, you know, grandfathers matter too. So this phenomenon of intergenerational transfer of health means that healthier people will beget healthier children, and the process continues on. But because we have people with quite poor health status in this country, it transmits itself on to subsequent generations.
So sticking with the topic of geographical differences in terms of life expectancy, how do we see it play out at the state level? And I'm particularly interested in where Oregon fits into this picture.
If we rank U.S. states by life expectancy, Oregon turns out to be around number 8 in 2020, ranked by life expectancy. Number 1 is Hawaii, and it's 2 years, 2 life expectancy years longer. That's a big difference. In Hawaii itself is about number 20 or 25 in the overall country health Olympics. It means that even our healthiest state, Hawaii, is not that healthy. And Oregon, you could put Oregon down somewhere around, Bahrain, and Hawaii would be somewhere around Slovenia. So take our healthiest state or take Oregon, which at number 8 is not doing so bad. It's up there, but for a country that is the richest and most powerful in world history, that spends half of the world's healthcare bill, we're not getting value for our money. To look at the other end, Mississippi is our least healthy state, and it's somewhere down around Bangladesh. So that's looking at states and their health outcomes. and then we can look within a state. And our Center for Disease Control allows you to graphically depict within Oregon the areas of higher life expectancy and lower life expectancy. The lower life expectancy is sort of in the southwestern part of Oregon, and the longest life expectancy is along the Columbia River. You know, we have tremendously detailed data, but when we drill down too closely, it sort of forces us to not look at the country as a whole. If we want to improve our health, we're going to have to deal with the major things I said, the economic inequality in the country as a whole, and the attention to early life that needs to be paid for the whole country.
So speaking of what to do about the problem, what do you think are the specific policies that would be most impactful in terms of improving the health and longevity of our people?
Studies show that from 1980 to 2020, about $50 trillion was taken from the bottom 90% and given to the top 1% in this country. That is, we've had a massive wealth pump that is taken from the rest of us and given it to the richest. And there are a variety of ways in which that happens. Among them, our tax system is incredibly unfair. If we ask who pays the lowest rate of combined federal, state, and local taxes in the United States in 2021, it was the richest 400, taking federal, state, and local income and the taxation of that, they paid 23% of that income in tax. The rest of us on our incomes that were much lower paid a higher percentage. Now, this wasn't always the case. Back in the 1950s, remember I said we were one of the healthiest countries then, the richest 400 paid 70-80% of their income in taxes. So that's the first thing we need to do, is restore the rates of taxation that we used to have. You know, I said Japan's the world's longest lived country, and we can take responsibility for that because we occupied Japan after the Second World War, and we had a series of policies that we made Japan undertake, one of which was to have a maximum income. That is, nobody in Japan in 1946 could make more than 47,000 yen. So we legislated a maximum income for Japan, and that, along with a few other policies, allowed Japan to become the world's longest lived country by 1978.
In a wealthy country at that.
Yes.
Let me ask a final question. What do you think ordinary folks can do to help bring about change? What's the main message you want people to take away from your book?
The main message is we need to inform each other. Most Americans think, you know, we're the best at everything. So we've won the most Nobel Prizes, have the most billionaires, we got to the moon, so we're really the best. And to try and get them to face that their health is really tremendously compromised by the political choices we make, political choices nationally, but also at the state level. You know, states with more liberal political policies have better health than states with more conservative policies. So creating awareness, I think, is the first step. And then vote for political candidates who are going to put some of these policies into action, you know, raise the minimum wage. But Let's think about a maximum wage. Americans think the rich don't pay enough tax, and they think they should, so let's raise taxes on the rich. Let's have a wealth tax. I mean, there are many things to do that need to be done, but they won't happen without creating broad awareness.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much.
Been my pleasure, Juan Carlos.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People. We will see you next time.
Hi, this is Walt Perezader with the Group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Hello, everybody. This is DK Home with another episode of Film at 11, KBOO's weekly movie review show. Joining us today are Jeff Godsell, Britta Gordon, and Matthew of KBOO's Bremlin Time, and myself, to give you some offerings. But first, hear this.
This is Britta Gordon, a contributor to Film at 11 on KBOO, where we talk about new films, old films, television shows, books on film and television, and related issues we think might be of interest to our listeners. Before we get started, I want to remind